everybody. Robbie here, and welcome to the Coach's Journey podcast, where I am delighted today to be joined by Alex Whitten. So the question of what makes a life well lived is at the heart of Alex's work, both as a coach and as the CEO of a charity that supports young people to realize their potential. In this episode of the Coach's Journey podcast, Alex tells me about the story of his career so far, from studying at Oxford University to volunteer work with young people to running a social enterprise and then deciding to become a coach. He describes how he emerged from a mindset of scarcity into one of abundance and opportunity as he came to realize his strengths as a coach, which were cultivated through his work with Universify, the charity he's the CEO of, and with the Mo Foundation. Alex shares insights into how he has built his coaching business alongside his work with Universify, and also how he is fulfilling his childhood ambition of becoming an author right at the end of this conversation. Alex is one of the new host team at the Coach's Journey, and he speaks really beautifully about the fundamental importance of authenticity, vulnerability, and creativity, principles that underpin his coaching, his writing, and his work as a CEO. We also talk about stories, memories, and listening for insight. We talk about how coaching skills can empower young people throughout their lives and how important it can be to bring these things to people early in their journeys. The power of someone taking your dreams seriously. We talk about taking a bigger picture view in order to see your own abundance. We talk about, and Alex gives a really beautiful dictation, essentially, of a really effective way to invite people to be coached and to enhance your agency as a coach. Alex offers a refreshing approach to framing conversations with prospective clients too, capturing the spirit of co-creation in a way that has universal appeal, and talks about how he's transferred that to charity fundraising too. Before we get on to speaking to Alex, I just want to talk about a few things that have been going on at the Coach's Journey. So one is that I've recently released a new ebook, An Introduction to the Coaching Business Flywheel. It's free of charge. It describes the flywheel, which is, I think, my most impactful thinking about coaching probably ever, certainly since I wrote about how I started my business as a coach in a long blog post, which is still on the Coach's Journey website, which in a way kicked off the whole Coach's Journey thing. The flywheel is exciting to me for two reasons. The first is, I think that it is the only five things that every coach who has a sustainable business has to do. So everything else is nice, but not vital. And these are the five vital things. But also, it puts them into a flywheel, which is an idea from Jim Collins, and makes them into a virtuous circle, which means that your coaching business will continue to grow momentum if you keep doing these things. And I think it's powerful for thinking about what activities we do as we build our coaching business, what support we buy, and many more things. So I hope you'll check that out. You can read more about it by going to thecoachesjourney.com and clicking on the link at the top, or the button that says The Coaching Business Flywheel. And if you sign up to the mailing list there, you'll get the ebook delivered to you free of charge. And hopefully it'll have a really big impact for you in the way that it has helps me and continues to help me think about developing my business. Right now, I'm putting energy into my coaching business in a business development way for the first time in a couple of years in a concerted way. And I'm doing it using the flywheel, and I'm doing it using the templates that are also now for sale as part of the Coaching Business Flywheel Booster Pack, which you can get on the Coach's Journey website too. So also, I just want to talk about a couple of other ways, because those signing up to that list, buying the booster pack, those are ways to support the Coach's Journey, to help us support more coaches, to help continue the podcast and grow it, and all kinds of other exciting ideas that we've got up our sleeves. But if you want to support the Coach's Journey in other ways, you might be interested in becoming a supporter, where you pay a small amount of money each month to us, and in exchange you'll get advance notice of guests, the chance to ask questions, a discount on the booster pack at some levels, and lots of other benefits. Or you might be interested in joining the Coach's Journey community. Alex talks about that in this interview, and he and the rest of the host team have all been members of the community at different times. So that gives you a sense of the kind of people that you'll meet, that you'll be connected to as you join that community. The community itself is a flexible, affordable group coaching program. You can pay £20 a month or up to £100 a month to come to a certain number of group coaching calls each year. And if you pay the £100 a month, become a full member, which is limited to just 8 people, then you get some one-to-one time with me too, amongst many other things, including the full members get free access to the booster pack, which normally sells at £249. So there's another little incentive to join, to come along to one of the Coach's Journey community calls. And if it's not for you, what makes it a flexible program is you can arrive and leave anytime. So I hope you might consider joining that. I'd love to have you as part of the community, to connect you to some other amazing coaches and have the opportunity to coach you as part of your journey. I'm super grateful to everyone who's been a supporter and a member over the years, but particularly to Alex Whitten, to David Norris, to Jessica Jem, to Joey Owen, and to Ruth Saville for your ongoing support. And last thing before we get on with the show is, it would mean a lot to us if you could click subscribe, rate the podcast wherever you are. We've got big plans for the show. And if you love it, we'd love it if you could show that by following us, rating us, reviewing us, wherever you get your podcasts. But now I just want to introduce you to Alex. I loved having this conversation with him. As I say right at the start, I loved getting the chance to see him as a guest and dig into his story in that way as an interviewer throughout the conversation. But especially as it goes on, we get to hear and feel more and more of Alex's creativity, his wisdom, the vulnerability and courage he brings to his business and to his work more widely. One of the things that was really meaningful for me listening back is at the end how he really holds what this thing, the coach's journey is about. You can do this thing coaching however you want. And Alex talks really beautifully about using his coaching business to create the life that he wants and how you can do that too. He also ends with some beautiful practical stuff and some great metaphor and analogy. So make sure to listen all the way to the end on this one. But mostly I'm just really thrilled to get to introduce you to the fantastic Alex Whitten. Alex Whitten, welcome to the Coach's Journey podcast.
Robbie, absolute pleasure to be on.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. So listeners who are on top of things with the Coach's Journey will know from episode 56 and other bits and pieces of us talking about it that you're one of the now team of hosts for the show. And you're that because you know my work and you know the show. And for everything I know about you, like, I'm really excited to have you bringing your energy and your perspectives to making this thing that we're now speaking on into something new. And I guess I'm curious in this moment what it's, you know, you're now on the show. That's what we're doing. I mean, it could go horribly wrong and we could stop it and start again, but I doubt we will. And that almost never happens. In fact, I don't think it's ever happened that I've got this far in and scrapped the intro. Only when I gave the name of the podcast wrong or that kind of thing have we started again. But like, you know, what I noticed was I'm excited that I get permission now because we've worked together in different ways through the Coach's Journey community for quite a while now. But I get permission in this conversation to ask you about a load of stuff that normally, that it's in service of me, not in service of you, which is how we normally are. So that's one of the things I notice. I'm curious, what do you notice this new kind of conversation that we're having and the fact that it's a conversation in public and the fact that it's a conversation on this particular show?
Yeah. So two things. First, I always, and maybe it's because I was a fan of the show, always wanted to be on it. But I was like, oh, you know, when I've really made it as a coach, I'll be on the Coach's Journey podcast. And we'll probably get to this, but I wouldn't say I've made it in the way that I consider you've made it as a coach. And that's interesting. Before our preamble, which definitely settled nerves, I was like, I have never spoken about myself for probably two hours. So excited by that and what comes up. I know that I can definitely do it. So just making sure that there's some value in it. But yeah, they're the two things, excitement. And yeah, well, apparently I've made it as a coach now. So,
exactly. I was going to say that, you know, it's like you could wait to be on the show until you've made it, or being on the show could be a sign that you've made it. Obviously we'd have to define what made it was. And I think like it's interesting, isn't it, because on the show over the years, especially because it's been a podcast since we said 2019, I think, didn't we? You know, I think people are much more aware of podcasting now than they were in 2019. I was a relatively early adopter. I've been listening to, what was the first one that I listened to a lot? Football Weekly, probably by The Guardian, since like 2008, 9, something like that. And so that's a long time. But for some people, for a lot of people, including some of the host team, they've come to podcasting really through the show. And so over the years, there's been a bunch of people who I've interviewed where it's been a kind of, some people are absolute pros, have been interviewed a million times, are totally used to it. And some people don't feel like that at all. And that's been really interesting, a part of this really, that always a part of interviewing people is them stepping on a stage in a strange way. Because although we're having one conversation, it's like a weird part of the 21st century, isn't it? That we're having a conversation now and we have no idea who will be listening to it when. and what they'll make of it. And some part of us has to kind of hold that, hold that, which is weird.
And I remember listening to the Katie Harvey episode, the pandemic one, maybe 6 months ago. And it kind of throws you back in, but also, yeah, there was definitely some things where I was like, there are parts of, you know, it being a just generally terrible time, but some opportunities or seeds in terms of you can create things in different ways have clearly come out of it. But you go, if those conditions could be created by me in like a more controlled way, actually what could come of that? And that was really interesting. And to be kind of put back in there and to consider some of the challenges that actually become very apparent in a coaching business that you might not really consider beyond the hypothetical of like, well, what happens where everyone's world changes and what feels appropriate to kind of invest in might change dramatically too, or actually everyone kind of goes into a bit more of a fight or flight mode, and it's a ground to go, this is what I need, is almost harder as well. So yeah, it was really interesting to consider it in retrospect. Yeah, and as you say, who knows when this will be listened to, and the fact that some of the episodes listened to now, those guests are coming back or have been on more recent shows, and to hear how the work evolves or develops.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, that's a nice reflection on that episode with Katie. So people who haven't listened, basically in about, I can't remember what it was, like March 2020, April 2020, I coached Katie, I think was coaching me or at the time or supervising me. And she just mentioned she'd made this PDF because lots of coaches were asking her, like, or she was supervising lots of coaches at the time. She does in her practice, like, this is how I remember it. Like, what do we do now? What is she noticing? And what does all her tens of thousands of hours of coaching like bring in? And so we did a fairly fast turnaround, get on for an hour. She had COVID at the time, I think more seriously than she might have mentioned it in the episode, but afterwards she was like, oh, I did have it. And I was like fine for that 2 hours, you know, that we were speaking, but not for lots of the other parts of it. And but it's interesting. But it's lovely to hear. So if I'd had to name an episode probably that wouldn't age well, it might be that one. But that's like an amazing reflection. It does remind me that, you know, I do this with the podcasts I listen to. You don't listen to them. Like, I hardly listen to any of them in real time. Some of the sports ones, that's it, really. Everything else happens like on intuition and whim, except occasionally I get an email or a notification or whatever that says, here's an interview or an episode, and I think it sounds cool. But mostly, you're listening to it completely out of time. And yet, despite everything, there's insights that emerge. So we can trust, really, that whenever people are listening to this, and we actually don't know when it's coming out, so we're recording this. So, you know, whenever it comes out, whenever people are listening, they'll if they're listening for insight, they'll find insight. I think that's one of the interesting things. In fact, something what I love, like doing this, like I say, it's really fun for me because I'm going to get to ask you a load of questions that I wouldn't normally get to ask in a coaching session, but also I get to do research on you in a way that I don't, and perhaps should, just in this moment thinking, do for all my clients. I don't, you know, I look them up when they're coming to me, but I don't necessarily dive into them in the way that I do when I'm going to interview them. And I had I loved reading one of your blogs about what if we're swimming in inspiration, something like that. Like that idea that inspiration can be everywhere instead of being something that we like sometimes happen upon or sometimes falls on us. Or, you know, I can't remember the exact language you used. Feels like that. So that's one of the things like I'm noticing in this moment that we're in, you know, we get to invite that for listeners. We get, as we do in a coaching session, we get to invite and say, like, what's the insight that's come from this? And listen for that insight because you only need one, right? In episode 56, we talked about it. I mean, lots of you did, we all did, but Ruth in particular, talking about, you know, the moment in an episode of a podcast that is the life-changing moment, really, is the fork in the road. So yeah, we're just setting ourselves low standards for this conversation for what might happen for people. Anything you want to say to that, Alex? I'm aware I've just done a little monologue about podcasting.
No, but I think it builds on what we spoke about in yesterday's episode with the whole team, which, yeah, if people haven't listened to it, they should, because there was a really beautiful moment with Ruth, as well as the best understanding I've ever got of a parasocial relationship.
This is just like, if people haven't been back to that one, if they don't want to go now, you've mentioned the word parasocial, I don't know what will get them to listen to that episode.
Um, But yeah, lost my train of thought there. What was really interesting is that point you made of, I mean, I'm currently reading a book about books as physical objects. And obviously they are what the majority of knowledge is being contained in. Obviously now we've got the internet, but actually in some ways, what records are we now creating through podcasts has just been a really interesting thing. Given that originally probably all information was oral, and some of the things that have lasted the longest are oral tradition and history. And so that, yeah, fascinating to see it almost coming around and considering, you know, who knows, in 250 years, this conversation could finally be insightful to someone, or it could be like tomorrow. Let's hope if it's 250 years, I'll have made it as a coach.
By then you're banking on still being around, because the medicine will have extended life that long. Yeah, we were talking a little bit before we switched on, weren't we? You were talking about the value, the importance of fairy tales. But it's interesting that, like, so I like that picture you just gave of the kind of the oral history being passed down, which is interesting. Like, there's an amazing, I might have talked about this on the show before, it really changed the way I think. There's an amazing little series of podcasts by Malcolm Gladwell about memory. And the way memory actually works, according to those podcasts, which is on what's it called, Revisionist History in season 2 or 3, is a lot more how folktales work, right? Which is that your memory basically creates an internal folktale, which isn't really true, but which, you know, and often isn't true, which is like terrifying when you consider how the justice system works, for example, relying on eyewitness testimony, which is just not, memory is just not real. It's just not factual as far as the research goes. And people in the research, just on that show at least, seem to be very clear about that and know it. And yet that doesn't, you know, we don't necessarily have a better way to replace something like memory in there. But memory is just create an internal folktale which contains the message. The important message, the important thing to remember about that thing to help you live. And that's what folktales are doing. And then we had books which contained it much more, but now we get this like combination of the two, right? Which was, we get the oral thing with all the feeling that goes with it, and the subtext that we can read into people's energy and that kind of thing in conversation, and it's kind of easier to absorb. But we also get the permanence, so that people will be able to. And it, like, I'm aware that it happens for like you know, you're kind of naming it now, it happens for people. If you've been podcasting a long time, like, I mean, I haven't, but if you were James Richardson off Football Weekly and now Totally Football Show, or you were Joe Rogan, you'd be able to go back to 15, maybe even 20 years ago and find out what you thought then and get like your own eyewitness testimony to what life was like compared to, or what football was like compared to how you remember it.
There's a weird thing as well, isn't there? Slightly scary. But, and I'd say it's the same with podcasts and books, because they can be accessed as in their own right as a single thing, that there's something fixed there that might be an articulation or expression of you at some point, but almost certainly pretty much after it being written. I try and write regularly, and I'm still working on that book, as everyone is in some ways, but there's that thing, isn't there, that when I started it, which was to try and consistently do it, which is probably 2019, to where I am now, is very different. And you probably finish it and start the next one, because what it captures is going to be quite different. One of the things that, when you're talking about memory, that reminded me, I was reminded of, is I remember doing a week at uni on oral history. So I did do history at uni. It wasn't just completely random. And this really beautiful, like, what is the benefit or purpose of oral history? And the obvious but not necessarily correct answer, or where the debate is, it fills in the facts where we don't have the information. But to the point you're talking about, doesn't often do that because of the misremembering. There's this really beautiful, one of the early kind of arguments for actually its value is the subjectivity in understanding what the past means to us in the present and how we construct the present based on that. And this guy was interviewing some Italians who'd been involved in some workers' strike in sort of the early 50s, and they kept misremembering the date of it. And for lots of reasons, I think it's because the outcome of the actual strike led to the death of one of the workers, but actually no meaningful change. Whereas I think 3 years later, there was a sort of shutdown of all workers in Northern Italy and had far bigger impacts. And when he was interviewing someone and corrected them, they went, the date doesn't matter, it still means the same thing. But yeah, so there's something really beautiful there. around kind of stories and understanding, you know, what's the story we're telling and what does that tell us about us now? And kind of being aware and present to that, to think about what might we tell, but then, you know, how we'll pick something up, which is someone's story, and go, this is fact, when they're probably very different from that.
Yeah, so much in there. And I thought about that too, that one of those first things you said, like, it's also, you know, that you kind of, people draw conclusions about people from one book or one podcast episode that they listen to or listen to some of or read some of or just read an article about in the New York Times or whatever it is. And they draw these conclusions based on that. But then I've also thought about the fact that I'm drawing conclusions based on partial things, even for something like Tim Ferriss, where I've listened to so many episodes over the years. I've drawn conclusions from Tim Ferriss about that, but I've only listened to at most, I don't know, 30% of those episodes. I've listened to them based on my interest. And so I've got no idea what's happening in the ones that I'm not interested in, which could be that I'm selecting out for, I don't know, his like fascination with the Nazis or whatever. Now, I'm pretty sure it's not the case, but I don't know. Right. I'm making an extrapolation too, like we all are with that stuff. And I think that's really interesting. And then, yeah, it's also interesting to be talking about story and memory because we're about to do some of that, right, in this conversation. Yeah. Like it's, you know, that is the format of these calls and it's what we're going to do now. And in fact, let's do that move. Right. So this is like, what's the, we know this is not going to necessarily be accurate. Maybe it is, but what's the memory you have of when you first came across coaching in the way that we think about it now?
Yeah. So this I did think about before, and I think the proper kind of introduction to coaching is way later, but I remember watching one of those like Thursday afternoons or 6 p.m. Channel 5 TV shows that was someone who was, I think, called a life coach. That basically went into someone's house and life and was like, this is what you should do. And by the end of the week, their life was transformed.
You remember what the show was called?
I don't, and it really annoys me. I don't know if it's true, but for some reason, I mean, this is like 19 years ago. The host was maybe called Nikki or the coach.
Okay, if anyone's listening to this and remembers this show, let us know so that we can find a link to it and put it in the show notes and also all watch it. Because how interesting. So roughly what year would this have been? Like, did you say?
I mean, that's got to be the noughties.
Yeah. So like maybe 20 years ago. Yeah. 19 years, you said. So it's maybe 2004. Yeah. Right, yeah. Right. Yeah, interesting. So there was something there about life coaching that was present. And like, yeah, what's your memory of your response to that show?
I think probably the same as any Channel 5, 6 p.m. show. Like, oh, this is interesting. Don't know. I think I might have watched a few at this time. You know, I watched TV with my family. But I say that maybe in like a humorous sense that actually one of the things I can find challenging is not necessarily the misrepresentation, but there's this real difficulty to articulate or understand what coaching is because it can be so broad. And in some ways, kind of a show like that does seem to catch all the things it can be, but sometimes all the things that it can be inferred to do in a not positive way. So it's like the idea of it being a tool to fix or to create some sort of massive change within like a week. But then, yeah, maybe let's fast forward, 11 years? And I first came across coaching as I'd know it today, when I volunteered for a charity I now work at, Universify, that uses coaching in residentials and it supports young people from underrepresented backgrounds to essentially realize their potential regardless of that background. So both thinking about what their options are, making more informed decisions about what is best for them based on like a broader knowledge of what their opportunities are and helping them in that moment, which is around 16, where they have to pick their subjects, they have to get good grades in their exams, and a moment that actually can probably dictate or turn the next 20 years of your life into a completely different life, kind of acts as that sort of a support mechanism there.
And just for listeners, right, you're slightly underselling yourself in Universify, right? Like, Alex, when it comes to professional life, you've made it. You're the CEO. Right? It's like, it's the best job. It's like, you know, and so I just want to catch that because it's like, you really undersold it there. And I know that might be because we might get to this, right? That might be because of how you feel about being a CEO. I don't know, but
I think we've had a whole one of our sessions has been all around that. So no, really good catch.
So the charity of which you are a CEO, the CEO now, which does all that amazing work that you just described for people. This is right. I think I've read this. You know, people who could potentially go to an amazing university, but might for whatever circumstance not make it there, to help them fulfill their potential. And you were volunteering for that organization, is that right? When you came across coaching there?
Yeah. So, the charity CEO of me has now come out. It's like, yes, we do kind of like university destinations, but actually more broadly, what will realizing your potential be as a young person? So, I mean, it's a really interesting one because like university is the vehicle, and for the young people we work with, often a context that they won't consider themselves belonging in. But actually, if you can take them and put them in that environment and they thrive, they might still, success doesn't mean, oh, now I'm going here. It means I want to go here because, or this isn't for me because, and therefore I'm going to do this instead. Which I think is where my perspective has actually shifted while doing it and seeing the value of coaching as a tool for making more informed decisions, rather than a kind of transactional thing. But going back to that, yeah, so volunteered on the very first program, and that was at a time where previously I'd at university trained as a peer supporter, which was kind of a listening, reflective listening practice through their counseling service. Really enjoyed that. And was more at that point of I'm graduating, don't have very concrete plans. I'd actually applied for like a mental health social work graduate scheme, which I didn't get on, which is probably for the best, I think, for me then. And so I ended up doing this volunteering, knowing that I wanted to do something that kind of made a difference. And at that point wasn't, I often flippantly tell people I wasn't willing to do 5 more years at university to become a psychologist, but I think there's maybe something more about like commitment there rather than because I could do the 5 years. I mean, I really enjoyed the 3 years I did university, but we might get onto that. So ended up volunteering on this program, which was a summer residential for these young people, aged sort of 14, 15, followed by the coaching, followed by a revision residential for their exams. And I think I did a day long coaching training with another excellent organization, Coach Bright, who work in a very similar space. They do short coaching programs, I think for 8 to 18 year olds now, from very similar backgrounds. And they also support young people going into university as well as into employment now as well with coaching. So yeah, really cool stuff. And yeah, remember doing that training, applying it, and then coaching a few students on the program. Didn't really consider it beyond this tool as part of my volunteering. And then probably properly engaged with coaching some more about a year and a half later when Coach Bright came and did the training for our next cohort of volunteers. And at this point, I was working a day a week for Universify as their program coordinator. And the practical charity approach was, oh, well, we're paying this organization to do some great coaching training, but long-term would be better for us to bring that in-house. And so Coach Bright, training, or all the Coach Bright staff have been trained by the Mo Foundation, and they recommended that. They're like, if you want to learn more deeply, well, actually, I remember this more fully in that I remember sending this vague email about, would love to learn more, but the subtext being like, as a charity, you probably can't afford forever to pay for this training or want to bring it in house, which I could have just said at the time, and they'd have been just as generous and going, well, if you want to learn more, go to the Mo Foundation. And so trained there, I think it would have been the winter of 2017.
And just for regular listeners, we were talking about this a bit in episode 56, which like you said, we recorded yesterday as we're having this conversation. We'll remember that Katrina Horry is a trainer at the Mo Foundation, or was, and Jeffrey Wotherspoon as well. So we've, like, the Mo Foundation has touched this show a couple of times, but for people who don't know about it, again, tell us something about the Mo Foundation. And also, I guess, what that training was like when you stepped into it.
So the Mo Foundation, they essentially gift or provide very accessible coaching training for individuals with the ethos that if we can empower our own lives positively, we can then kind of empower the lives of others and impact others. And in particular, it has a focus on working with people that might work in the youth space or supporting young people. Because again, if we can equip young people, I think, with some of the skills and approaches of coaching, then, you know, you're learning skills that will help you really navigate life in a fulfilling way. And I did do Google yesterday, something like they've gifted something like £3 million worth of coaching training. So in that, people who can't pay don't pay, but people who can pay contribute a bit. But the course that they deliver has been donated, I think I'm right in thinking, by the coaching company that Carol Wilson runs. And so it's that 5-day training. And then the Mo Foundation delivers to these cohorts of between like 12 and 20, which is, they've done their first or are doing their first in-person one since the pandemic at the moment as we speak. But it's been online for the last couple of years. I did mine in person. I remember it. And the in-person ones were in kind of gifted spaces. So it was the pavilion of the GSK cricket ground in Boston Manor. Which is actually quite fun. Quite,
I bet, it's very cool to get to go to those kind of spaces. I'm just like laughing at GSK. People don't know, it's like a massive pharmaceutical company having a cricket ground. And then, of course, it makes total sense that they would be generous to a charity called Mo, like Mo, who are doing such great work. But it's just these kind of, and I love it when you're based. Is it, so? Wait, where is it? Is it near London? Where is it?
So where that Mo training was in Boston Manor, so like near Ealing, kind of Acton Way in London. Yeah,
for me it's like one of, so we moved out of London, as many listeners all know, in 2022, and one of the sad things about it is, like, one of the things, my favorite things about the two periods that I've lived in London is just ending up in these incredible places. You know, if you live in London long enough, you can't help but at some point find yourself in this weird old place, or this, you know, somewhere with an amazing view, or some, you know, bar in what used to be an old whatever. And it's, so I love hearing that story. What are you, because it's interesting, you'd already had some of the listening input, it sounds like, with that peer supporter stuff when you were a student. You then had Coach Bright, you'd seen their training at least twice probably by that time, and you'd experienced some of the stuff with what it was like to do these skills with the students who were on the Universify programs. What do you remember being new or different or surprising about doing a more in-depth training with Mo?
I remember distinctly the first day, in that it was very similar to the Coach Bright training, which makes a lot of sense.
Right, because Coach Bright, I didn't know that. So weirdly, a tiny little aside is, when one of my favorite networking things pre-pandemic, one of the only ones that I ever found that really worked, was a series of events the RSA had called RSA Engage. And the RSA is, for people who don't know, is the Royal, it's one of those cool places that you end up in London if you hang around long enough. You can go in there and go to the cafe now, it's public. And it's a very cool organization. The RSA stands for the Royal Society for the Arts, but the actual name is the Royal Society for the Arts, Manufacture and Commerce, which for me is just such a fascinating mixture of things. And I've seen some of the, you know, all their events are free and there's loads on YouTube, and I've seen some of the most interesting thinkers in the world speak in the RSA, and it's been fantastic. But they used to have these events where you would have a number of fellows, I can't remember if it was like 8 or 10, give a little pitch about their idea, and then there'd just be a load of conversations. So there'd be like 4 pitches and then a load of interesting conversations. And sometimes I would go and speak to the people who'd given a presentation, but almost never, in fact. Mostly I'd just be talking to interesting people who are in the room, because the RSA is full of interesting people. But he's called Robin, right? The founder Robin of Coach Chu. Yeah. Robin gave a presentation at one of those things once. And I remember having a conversation with him in a park near Embankment Gardens about we're doing some work for Coach Bright in their early days, and it didn't ever happen, but it easily could have. Working with them, cool organization with great stuff. I think Robin's moved on now. I think I saw he's working for School of Happy Startup School or something. School of Social Entrepreneurs.
The other SSE.
Okay, so the first surprising thing was that it was the first day you'd heard twice before. Yeah, what else did you notice in?
I think there was a really beautiful, it's actually quite funny how vivid it is. There's a really beautiful moment at the end where we're sat in this circle, and I think it was, everyone had to share a reflection from the day. And one of them was, a few people went, actually, how much they appreciated the contributions of other individuals in kind of a way that I'd never been in an environment where someone, I think, simply said to another participant, like, your way of being has made me feel so like safe in this very new environment, which was really, I was like, wow, this is an amazing kind of space to be in to learn, which was great, because I think I remember then it was you did 3 days in person, then you had sort of 6 week break coaching one of your buddies from the program, and then 2 weeks for assessment, etc. I think it was day two, I remember probably being a bit too confident, like, well, I know all of this, totally ballsing up the exercise we were doing there in a really great way, to the point that whenever I demo it now, I'm really on my toes for it. And
what's the exercise?
It's the, I'm sure lots of coaches know this, it's like the helicopter view, which is it basically, let's say, helicopter view of your life. So I'd put like R in the center of a circle, and I go, well, at the moment, where's your energy going, Robbie? And the aim isn't to sort of linger on any of them, but it's actually to create a picture. And as we kind of fill up the circle, kind of see what comes. And it's a great way to then set some goals for your clients. You know, well, which of these three would make the biggest difference if you worked on them consistently with me?
Yeah, this is a cool exercise. I actually don't know this one. And so I think this is just cool to slow down on. Mm-hmm. So is this right? It could be a first coaching session, or if you're coaching somebody for the first time or as a one-off, and they say, I just don't know where to start, or I just want to get a bigger picture view of, I don't want to know where I should be focusing. And the question is, where do you put your energy at the moment? Or something like that, and then just getting a load of answers out for that, and then mapping that out on a bit of paper.
Cool. Essentially that, and then obviously different.
How did you balls it up?
I was instantly like, oh, you've mentioned this thing, tell me more. It's like, right, yeah, this helicopter's crashed and burned in that,
or it's just hovering very low down above one bit.
A blaze of grass may float everywhere. So and that was really interesting, because I think probably one of the things that it really played with is the perfectionism that was instantly, and that was the last exercise of the day. I was like, I need to do this again right now to, I suppose, as much to get it, but also to prove to myself that I can do it. I'm not a shit coach because I can't do the helicopter view.
Let's do that, because you mentioned it. Alex is making a reference to, I think, like, I love it in the coaches journey community, just sometimes someone starts at the wrong or the right moment. The first check-in that Alex ever did on a coaches journey call was everybody saying, I'm a shit coach because, and we did about three rounds of that, and that was like, Alex had never met anybody, he came along to a group coaching call, and that was the first thing we did, which I think is a great way to start a call.
Actually, I was reflecting on that the other day, because I thought it might come up either here or in the other show episode we did. What a beautiful thing to instantly humanize all the other people that coming into a group, go, oh, these are going to be some top draw coaches. And it's not to say that they aren't, and they still are, but they've all had these challenges that I have had or face or actually anticipate. Really lovely.
Just as a little aside, I can't remember if I said this at the time, but when I went to one of the Rich Litvin intensives that I went to, which is, people who don't know, is Rich who wrote The Prosperous Coach with Steve Chandler, he used to, I don't think he does them anymore, run a 3-day event with about 150 coaches. As part of that, there was a small group exercise. It was a small, we each were in a small group so that you would be in the main room with the main activity and then you would return to a small group. The idea being that, I guess, that helps you manage your way through it. It allows you to get some more high touch support. And creates a peer group. And the way that Evelyn Brink, who led the group that I was in, who's a really interesting woman, people could check out. She used to be a Madonna impersonator and is now an amazing coach. I don't know if everybody did this in all the groups, but in ours, we started with what I don't want you to know about me is, which I've got to say is a pretty heavy first thing to do. Like, it's really hard to find something that you are, that is uncomfortable to share, but not that uncomfortable, you know, like, but it is, you're right. Like, that had the same effect as what you just described. It really humanized this little group of people and made the connection between them really strong. And I think we did it in that because in the pre-call questions in that call, several people, two or three, had talked about worrying about maybe I'm rubbish altogether or I just, my fear is I'm just a shit coach or whatever it was. We, you know, before the calls, people who don't know, we do some pre-call questions. And I just thought that would be an interesting way to step in. And right, what a great way to humanize that group of people. And it sounds like in their own way, Mo must have been doing that, because that's how you get that feedback at the end of the first day or second day, whenever it was, of I can like, you're making me feel really safe by the way of being here. Right, but you had to prove to yourself that the voice in your head saying, I'm a shit coach because I can't do the helicopter exercise. Nope, that's not true, because I can do it. Yeah. And Alex, like, this might not be, I don't know if you know this or if this is because I think we're not going to talk too much about it because people might cancel and stuff gets moved and things happen, but you might well be interviewing another Mo trainer, Mark Bixter, and he might know more about this, but am I right in thinking that the founder of the Mo Foundation died?
Yeah, Darren passed away, I think, in April.
For various reasons, yeah. He was on my list of guests, you know, for a long time. I never got around to reaching out to him because I'd heard about him from via Mo and perhaps from Katrina and Jeffrey. Yeah. It was amazing. I remember there being amazing tributes that made their way onto my LinkedIn feed. And what a thing. We have 3 million hours of coaching, 3 million pounds of coaching training, hundreds of people, all those ripples, including the ripples from everyone Coachbrite has ever trained, right? Like, what a thing.
Yeah, and I mean, I suppose a testament to Darren, it might be justice compared to other people, because I remember he came in person at the end of our assessments to actually share, kind of, because he was free. He was like, this is why I do Mo and this is what it's about. And it's a really beautiful story of kind of embodying like a mother's love, essentially. And I definitely can't see just the story, but it was absolutely beautiful that he kind of stood up, talked about everything he was doing and did, but then the humanists go, this is where it's come from, because it's that point of he was a very successful coach. There was no need for him to have to set something up like Mo, but I can't remember the story well enough, but it was something like he kind of committed to it among a group of people at an event, when I'm going to do this thing as a testament to like our mother's love. After, I think she passed away quite unexpectedly too. And yeah, I think probably beautiful to see how it lives on in terms of the communities it creates. It's got a very like prosperous alumni group. And the fact that people that go through the program become trainers on the program.
And so you completed the program with Mo. Presumably you passed your assessment despite ballsing up the helicopter.
There was no helicopter view in the assessment. Okay. So.
and then what happened next? At the same time, you're still working a day a week at Universify, or has that evolved by then?
Yeah, it's still a day a week. I think that the short story of what happened next is nothing. When it came to coaching, and it's a really interesting point in my life where I was doing a lot. And then the other thing that kind of comes to mind is one of the things you have to do at the end of the Mo course is sort of in a year's time, I'll be here, both in terms of like a intangible and tangible way. And I think I can't remember the exact words, but remember it being something around I will be loving and listening to myself as much as I try to be for others, which Well, I mean, this is when we get into story, but with retrospect, I just didn't do a good job of for about 2 years, which is, you know, where the coaching kind of remained sort of dormant, in that I busied myself with other things, work being one of them. So I'm working day a week for Universify, 4 days a week for the company founded by the founders of Universify, essentially, which is an education company, and doing other things that were, with hindsight, really invaluable. I volunteered for, sort of, again, I'm doing myself a disservice. I ran a social enterprise within Oxford that was a football league that donated its proceeds to charity. But I remember acquiring that kind of voluntary role out of a "am I doing enough" type mindset, which obviously was definitely the space I was in at that point, and not necessarily the space in which to like pursue coaching further. So
what give us a bit more flavor of "am I doing enough"? What was behind that? Enough what?
I think comparison was very, self-comparison was very strong in lots of people I knew pursued different career paths that are probably more structured, more like...
Right. And you actually, in other selling yourself short, we haven't mentioned that you were at Oxford, right? One of the oldest universities in the world, you know, one of the most prestigious in the world. It's really hard to get into. And right, I can imagine, knowing from, you know, people I know close to me who have been to Oxford or the other place, that, you know, I can imagine what the people that you studied with, the kinds of things they might have been moving into at that. I mean, you could probably give us, like, so you're having these comparison thoughts. What were they doing? Were they investment bankers by this point, or were they in, you know, civil service fast streams? Like, where had they gone?
I think in all of those routes, and there's no like specific individuals, which is really interesting. But I think almost being part of this, I don't know, collective mindset of you have to be doing something that is seen as objectively good or respectable, in a way that working for like a part-time on two different things, which actually I found like enjoyable and fulfilling, didn't feel like it fit the narrative that I'd created for myself within this bubble that I'd probably been part of, which actually, you know, being a coach now is the thing that you try and challenge or at least deconstruct and go, well, what is true here? And I think probably in the same way that, you know, I was trying to do the helicopter view of prove that I could do it. It was sort of like prove that I could have a successful career without knowing what success looked like to me, or actually even objectively, which, again, that would be a really funny one, actually. Like, if you were to coach you 5-10 years ago, what would be the things that you would be working on? And probably I'd be working on the fact that, like, I had a lack of articulation of the vision of the life that I would want to create for myself.
Do you think that's possible, Alex? It just occurs to me, like, at that age, because let's think about it, like, what age is this when you're...
This is like 19 to 21.
Yeah, exactly. It feels like... I just wonder, like, I don't know if this is true. I guess some people have it, don't they? I did a talk this week for my sister-in-law works, is a head teacher in a school for people with eating disorders. And I went to give a little career talk there because she asked me to, and I thought it'd be interesting. And I found myself saying to them and thinking, they were aged something like 14 to 18, you know, like, you can't know it at that time. Maybe you can't know what the kind of life you want to create until you've lived some life. I think that's certainly what it felt like for me. Like, I definitely lived through a kind of Saturn Returns crisis. Luckily, I didn't, you know, kill myself like Joplin or Cobain or whoever else. But, you know, Robert Holden once said to me, he thought that the bit, the 27 to 35 bit, the post-Saturn Returns, that's when you have your like second go at being an adult, learning from all the mistakes in the first go. So I guess I'm just wondering, what do you think? Do you think you could have, if you had been coaching yourself then, that would have been, might well have been what you've been working on. But do you think you could have known more, but could you have really known, or do you think you had to like get into it a bit more?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question.
And I guess you must think about this, of course, with the charity and the work with young people as well.
Yeah, I suppose two interesting things in that. Because the work Universify does is young people aged 14 to 16. I also work I'm a lead coach for the Bridging Project, which is a charity that coaches first generation students through their first year of university. So that's 18, 19, that kind of transition.
But first generation, does that mean like the first generation in their family to go to university?
Yeah, first in their family. And to your point, right, it's arguably, and I know some people that run other organizations, it's like until you get 17, 18, is coaching that valuable because of like brain development? I'm not going to pretend to know this. My partner knows a lot more about psychology than me. So I always self-censor here before I'm fact-checked.
But you've spoken to her a lot, right? So you probably know more about it than me or some of the listeners. So there's something about brain development that's happening.
I suppose that, I mean, one of the other things I did when I did my coach, around the time I did my coach training, was the mental health first aid training, which it's a short synopsis, basically, is a course that's delivered across many countries now and trying to equip people with the tools to support their own mental health and have a conversation around mental health in the same way that we might treat physical health, so physical first aid. So that premise of, well, actually, how can we support someone, that positive conversation around mental health? And there's a really great video as part of the training which talks about how brain development, the adolescent brain, I can't remember the neurochemicals, but essentially one of them is released around 15-16 that is basically encouraging you to flee the nest, which is the increase of risk-taking behavior. And so to that point, you're right, it's that period of life is probably one of massive experimentation. But then I kind of throw back, and what conditions do you want to experiment? And you probably, if I think of the science experiments I did at school, you'd write your method and what we're looking for. And I'd imagine that coaching might not get the same clarity in terms of what do you want, but it might provide that reflective space of, well, where are you, what are you exploring, and how do you want to explore that? And that check about what are you noticing from this exploration, and actually what might best serve that.
Yeah, and I don't think I agree with there's some kind of assumption in that question that I asked, I don't think I agree with. Because as you were speaking then, I was thinking, on behalf of everyone who's had coaching as someone older than 19 and try to articulate what they want in their life, like we all know it's not easy, right? So it's never easy. And to have had a real go at that at an early age, to then have something to match your experience of life against and run experiments against, right? Like if you have the intuition when you're 14 that there's a particular thing, or 16 that there's a particular thing that you might want to do, you then get, then throughout that next phase of life, you get to check that. And then when you come back to it, if you have a 27, 28 rockstar death age crisis, then you have all that evidence, conscious, much more conscious than you otherwise might. So, I'm really interested in what you said before and about young people being exposed to these skills, either as a kind of person being coached or a person coaching, because I just think we could probably talk for another 2 hours about just that. So yeah, I think it's really, I really love the way you talked about that then, and I for sure think that these conversations, like most of us, in fact, to kind of finish this thought, many people have a story about someone who's an adult, or usually an adult or someone older than them, in that age, 14 to 21, 22, who really saw something in them, who asked them questions or challenged them in a certain way, which made a really big impact on their life. And so, or you might have a number of them. And so like to have more space for that feels really valuable.
And just to jump on that very quickly, Robbie, I often frame it to people as, how often, and even people that I kind of have an initial call around coaching with, and some can go, this is really difficult. And I, well, when was the last time that someone asked you what you want or what you thought about it? And however structured a pipeline the education system is or isn't, which is a completely separate conversation, but how much space does it provide, firstly, for people to like dream, and for someone to go, okay, well, actually, if you were to run with that dream, what would it look like? Because I think there's a beautiful thing that coaching offers, which is that they actually will take your word on something, a coach will, in that I was talking to my coach the other day about, you know, what I really want to do is to write creatively more as one of the things that feels really important. And they went, well, you know, when we're talking next, the question would be how many books you want to have written by then. And I thought, oh shit, like they've taken this seriously in a way that, you know, sometimes it can be really difficult on your own to take the weight of your aspiration seriously, to hold that, and to nurture it, I suppose.
Yeah, what a beautiful thing. We probably, everyone listening also has a memory, like I certainly do, of times when at that age or younger, people didn't take seriously the dream or vision and the impact of that, right? So yeah, like sprinkling a few hundred more conversations where people ask you a dream and then believe you when you say it into it, you know, into the lives of young people, like what an incredible thing to do.
Yeah.
So I can't even remember where we digressed to this point, but I'm really glad we did, from. But I think it was not much happened next after Mo. So what we know from the start of the conversation in different ways, and people who have, yeah, looked you up, or we know that your work, you do some coaching now, and you're the CEO of Universify. So how did that happen? How did those two things happen?
Yeah, so graduated from Mo in December 2017, and then I think period from 2017 to 2019 was, I think, personal challenge of kind of hitting a wall, I think, and actually not being able to recognize kind of how personally like challenging it was and unsustainable. With retrospect, yes, and I'm glad this is a story, but don't think that I'm more self-aware of trying not to like manifest that for myself, because Mo has beauty rack. Mo now stands for me, others and everyone. And I think the way I was living my life is others and everyone. So it's kind of, and actually you're not serving, like you can't really serve from an empty cup. In 2019, Universal, I got a scaling grant, which is perfectly timed as the pandemic hit. That's a separate story, but it allowed myself and my colleagues to go full time for Universify, which in itself was incredibly exciting. And where we both assumed a lot more responsibility because we had way more time to try and grow this organization. And growing it meant kind of trying to partner with more universities or university colleges that host the program. Within sort of 6 months of that, the pandemic came and we had to move everything online. The team grew. So there were some really interesting experiences there. As with everyone, kind of, I moved home at that point to live with my parents, but flee the tiny flat on the Elephant Castle roundabout, which is, I realize another niche London reference, but also at that point, just before the pandemic, I'd had more time to manage the person that my colleague at the time I was line managing. And we talked about setting some goals for the year ahead because, you know, we had more time, that stuff. I forgot how much I really enjoy this. And in part, I think, because, you know, my coaching skills had maybe gone a bit rusty in the way that I'd done them in a Universify context. So I'd actually say one of the hardest things has been coaching young people, because it keeps you really honest as a coach. You have to ask the same questions, but with as much integrity as you would to an adult, if not more, because otherwise a young person can see right through you and go, what's this about? That's an aside. And during that kind of period, got involved with Mo again, ended up being part of the training team for the last in-person course before the pandemic, for the full in-person course, and just really loving it and thinking, I want to do more of this. And for Mo, that at that point, as they're fleshing out their pathway to lead trainer, which I'm still on, you have to get 100 coaching hours. So that's where I'd then messaged a group of friends going, I'm trying to get 100 hours of coaching. Would anyone like some coaching? And from there, that's where I think the kind of the coaching seed that had probably been like festering or dormant was starting to be watered again. Pandemic came, and it also forced us, as sort of side stories, universe-wise, coaching training was still being delivered, but by another charity kind of volunteering their time, and they weren't able to do it because of the pandemic. So I also redid our training and redelivered that, having done the most stuff. So there were these things of, oh, I'm really starting to enjoy this now, beginning to coach people again, practice helicopter view, and deliver the training. And it was just lighting me up in a way that the day-to-day aspects of Universe Final were really fulfilling, but there was something that, as we'd had to adapt to the pandemic, I'd taken a less frontline role in the work we do. And I think one thing I noticed, really valuing the ability to feel the difference you make, which however much satisfaction you get from a spreadsheet doesn't necessarily do for me. And so that's where coaching came in, and then was exploring, well, how can I see this further? And at which point you go back an episode and you can hear how I found the Coach's Journey podcast. But at that point, I had a conversation with work, sort of speed this up a little bit, which was, I really want to pursue this. There was that, it would be really terrifying to go full-time on this straight away, and I have absolutely no idea what I'm doing. And so they sort of said, well, can, you know, you could do it part-time, which is a funny point, because that's why I went to one day a week coaching, which is what I still do. And that was January 2021. And 4 days at Universe Lives. Also, coincidentally, the same time at which, like, my role changed to CEO, which was more like a name thing as much as it was like we've talked about this in one of our coaching sessions. And that's, I suppose, how I've kind of my meandering path with coaching to being a coach, being part of the work I do now.
Yeah. Yeah. So much in there, Alex, that we could kind of slow down on. And yeah, for people who haven't listened to that, to the episode 56, in that you talk about Jeffrey, who was on the show, Jeffrey Wotherspoon, sharing, who's one of the Moly trainers I mentioned before, sharing the episode in the group, and then you finding the podcast that way. I guess I'm curious a little. I mean, let's try and do a few of the things that are in there, but maybe first, so it's interesting that you kind of feel the being on the front line, seeing the change being made, the absence of that as you stepped more into leadership. And you know, that's something that I've noticed as a pattern with coaches, actually. I mean, it's an anecdotal pattern. I don't have any great research, but includes this show and other conversations. James Bianco springs to mind, saying, you know, even though he was definitely having, in some ways, a speech marks bigger impact, because he was a senior civil servant in international development, you know, he couldn't see or feel any of that. It's how I remember him as saying, but that when he got to coaching, he could really feel it. And it was actually my experience from being a charity manager. Sadly, maybe if I was a little bit, it happened, I had done that a bit more recently, I would have got to be called CEO. I didn't get to be called CEO, which is a sad state.
Yeah,
of affairs.
I mean, as someone that graduated from charity manager, yeah, Robbie, I'll unofficially.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. You can anoint me CEO. Yeah, yeah. I was an honorary CEO for sure of those organizations, but that was part of the feel for me there as well, right? It's like I remember one of my mentors when I worked in the arts, Dan Bates, talking about, I think he said this, you know, the joke is as the charity CEO, and he was the CEO of York Theatre Royal at the time when I was speaking to him, you know, the most creative decision you get to make is what color the walls are. You know, and that's like, that's for sure not true, but there is that feeling like a lot of what, this is what my memory was. I don't know if it feels like this. A lot of the job of the charity manager or CEO is to hold the whole thing together and to make sure it keeps going. And often that means repeatedly, I guess I'm seeing in this moment, stepping away from the delivery. And certainly for me, a big instigator for not going back to that after I took a career break was wanting to be closer to the delivery. And I guess, you know, I'm aware that one of the reflections I have on my time in some of those pre-coaching jobs is I wish I'd known more about myself, because there were probably ways to speech marks fix the job without having to leave in the way that I did. One of them, for example, was how important learning is to me, So if I got bored of every job I've ever done when I stopped learning it, you know, when I had speech marks mastered the kind of day to day. And then for me, it was kind of hard to stay interested in the day to day because I wasn't learning anything. But if I'd really known that, I could have just inserted some learning into my life at that time and felt really different. This is a very long-winded way of asking, when you then inserted this day a week of coaching, how did that change your energy for the management of the charity, for the spreadsheets, if at all?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a really good question because if you asked me, oh, where is this going? I can answer, well, I don't know if I'd want it to be as a full-time coach because there's so many things that feel really rich that would take, it's almost like the leaving the work to then create the work for yourself when actually it's already there. It's kind of like not recognizing the abundance you have if you sort of step back and see it from a different viewpoint.
So let me just check I've got that. So this is like, you're really seeing, yeah, right. It'd take a long time for you, like the impact you're having with young people through the work for Universify. If you were to try and create that in your own business to get to the scale and the texture of that impact might take years and you might never do it. Whereas you're right here, there's an abundance of that in your role.
But that not is, and I don't think it's just the impact bit, but the learning part in that there's a team that it's an absolute joy to work with and to learn from. And it's kind of like how that would manifest in my own coaching practice, or the effort to create that when it's something there that is so rich, and such a wonderful part of like working at Universify, is learning from being inspired by this quite small group of people that do incredible things, that teach you a lot, that show you a different perspective. And that it feels like I can contribute to in helping support them to learn as well in the same way. And there's the, well, there's a really beautiful thing here that I really value. So why would I kind of just abandon that for something that I have to, where I'd have to create it? So there's a really interesting, I think, to go back to your question, that what is that like frontline feeling thing is the, firstly checking what's the value, what's my role, and how can I create value in that role as chair CEO, and being aware that I've been learning that over time massively, and what it is this year is going to be very different to what it was last year, as we think of learning that actually being known for the good work we do is just as important as the good work you do. And there's a real opportunity to have some really interesting conversations with people who do really cool stuff that I care about in terms of education and learning. And it's like, well, I could have them in a coaching space, but they're already all here. And actually, there's an opportunity to create this kind of direct impact. I think, some of the coaching work I do is trying to be focused on social impact founders, not exclusively, but there's a ripple effect idea there that, yes, you could run an organization that works with 100 people every year and it makes big impacts. And why not work with 10 people that run 10 organizations that work with 100 people? And at the moment, I've got the opportunity to do both, and in different ways and with different challenges. And I think there's that sense of, if I woke up tomorrow and Universify didn't exist, not only would I be sad, but I wouldn't be equipped to maybe do the thing. I'd bring the things that I've not yet learned and have to still learn them, such as, finding that balance between like prioritizing moving things forward, but like the working in and on the business, which will be, is still a thing in coaching, right? Because actually, one of the things I've learned is a prosperous coaching business, however big it is, whether it's a day a week or 5 days a week, is not 5 days exclusively coaching, however much that's meaningful, because at some point there will be some people that go, oh, I'm done with this work. I don't need any more coaching. And you've got a gap. And because you've spent 5 full days coaching them, so you're going to do your weekend, there's another aspect there. And so I think it's almost your point, what you said, Robbie, really resonates. It's like checking in on the learning. I had a really powerful coaching session with my coach about 3 months ago that did make me notice that often it's useful to frame work. Well, everything actually is a relationship, and what's my relationship to it? And there were times at which Particularly historically, and actually still, I can be guilty of it, of having quite an unhealthy relationship with work, which is largely universal. And I think you talked about like 100% responsibility, and that resonates a lot, because I think having been at Universify from the start, and it's something that I take in my coaching as well, you're really invested in it, but actually you're not 100% responsible for it. And if you are, like, that is to its detriment if you are in that, in my coach business, if I go, oh, it's all on me if it succeeds or fails. Yes, there's a lot of responsibility I need to take, but actually it's not fully on me, and I'll probably work myself into the ground and just perpetuate struggle rather than prosperity. And within the Universify context, as it's grown, there is more stuff it does and needs to do that I have to be responsible for, but not responsible for it. It's like specific execution, or kind of like, it's not the weight that you have to solely carry. And that's a really interesting, like, I mean, the tenor of this meandering response highlights is something I'm learning day to day. And because both into like, while I like the analogy of relationship, and also probably the idea of organizations or businesses as organisms, is that they both change. And so you have to adapt them, and what you want from a relationship at a certain point might change, and what that organism needs from you might change. And it's then that conversation of, is this relationship still what we both wanted from it, and how do we meet that?
Yeah. Yeah. I love the, what do you call it? Meandering response so much in there. Like, one of the things I hear is, you know, I guess you see it in coaching sometimes, don't you? You kind of, if you really ask people what they want, which is, you know, is a theme we were talking about earlier, then sometimes they see that they have a lot of what they want right there. And that's one of the things I hear from this, you saying about, you know, there's this kind of, and I guess I'm really loving this reflection that we're doing on being part-time and that kind of thing, partly because there's this kind of story that only full-time coaching is acceptable or valid. And one of the lovely pieces of feedback we had when I spoke to Henrietta Nelson at the start of 2023, I think it was, where she talks in a really grounded way about how powerful it was for her to realize, oh, I'm a part-time coach right now, and that's okay because of all my other commitments in different ways. So I think one of the reasons that's important is because coaching is still so young. So we're still really learning, like, what are the different ways that it works? And, you know, like you said, a prosperous coaching business definitely isn't like 100% coaching. I mean, it is for some people, if you've got the kind of, if you work for one of those big companies like BetterUp and they just fire you clients, or you have other relationships like that. But most people wouldn't work full time coaching people. And in fact, I might have said this to you before, but I've heard Robert Holden, who I mentioned earlier, say he thinks no coaches should be full time, because you need to be interacting with the world in your own way as well as coaching people. And that shows up in different ways. For example, for me, it shows up making a weird podcast like this. But it can show up in all kinds of ways for people. And so I guess what I hear is there was an energy for more coaching, for pursuing that. And actually, Universify did an amazing thing, which employers sometimes do, which is like, sounds like they really sat down with you and looked at this problem together and came up with a solution that has worked out really well for everybody. Which is an amazing thing for an employer to do. And I love it when I hear about stories like that. So what, you might want to say something to that, but also my next question would be like, so what happened then next? We might come back to Universify and the CEO and that kind of thing, but what happened next with your coaching as you stepped into, you suddenly had a day a week? Like, what do you do in that day? How does it look a couple of years on?
Yeah, I think let's acknowledge that, because you're right. There's this beautiful thing that resonated with me, and like, the look after the people, then they'll look after the work. And actually, you're right. It would have been easier for Universify to go, no, that won't work, but actually to sit down and listen to me, what I was really grateful for, because I definitely have learned things through coaching or establishing a coaching business that makes me a better CEO, and actually vice versa. Really interestingly, really trying to better understand how we could collaborate with universities, for example. I don't know if this should be a weird plug, but if anyone works at university, email me. but better understand and realize that actually it's no different to coaching invitations, where it's actually like, I have this thing I'd really like to connect with you about. And just getting in touch, and with that authenticity of actually, I'm not here to sell you something. I'm here to understand. And if there's a way for us to co-create something, that's where we will do really great work that's aligned together.
Just to catch that, like, if anyone didn't get that, that was like a beautiful description of the kind of energy you can have in a prospective conversation with a client. I know that you were making that comparison, but I just want to make sure no one missed it, right? That you can be in that place of, I'm not here to sell something. I'm here to see if there is a way for us to work together and co-create something together. And if you read Dale Carnegie or you know, people like that who lived and breathed sales, that's what they used to do as well, right? That is how to do real, as far as I can tell, successful, meaningful selling. And, you know, exactly. I love the way you put that. So yeah, you could learn both ways from the coaching for Universify and vice versa.
Yeah. And then to come back to the, how did I do that day? Going back to memory, I do remember trying to go for like a walk before I start work every day and having absolutely no idea what I was going to do. But I think I sat down and reflected on the questions of like, who is it I'd like to coach? And of the coaching experience, what have I found valuable? And I also think I made sure that I had a call with another coach just to talk about ideas we had. And I think I had some coaching in that day. So yeah, I remembered what I was doing it for. I'd obviously did the thing that lots of people do is I started a website, which I'd written way before, but was going, oh, I need to get this copy better now. And I can't remember the specifics of how it then unfolded kind of day to day. But some of the things that feel resonant, it's like the learning journey of unconscious competence all the way through to unconscious incompetence all the way through to conscious competence. And I often like the analogy of, again, a relationship in that the first time you probably ask someone out, you have no idea what you're doing, and you just do it, and you make it up as you go along. And that's actually kind of what I was doing. And then... becoming more aware, you try and like control something or make it, oh, this is how it works, let's replicate this, without being organic. And so to put that into the tangibles, I was coaching a few people through invitation. And by invitation, I went, I'm starting this coaching thing, really want to coach some people. You'd be someone great to coach. And I think a few of them, I was like, I'll coach you for free for X number of sessions. I think it was 3 for your feedback. And some of those people I still coach today, and I'm currently in the process, and it came out of a community call with you, Robbie, of doing a kind of challenge of trying to invite 50 people to a coaching conversation, which is simply, for those that don't know what the invitation challenge is, just going, I'd like to invite you for some coaching because I'm trying to get, and for me, my reason is I'm trying to get better at sharing my work, because you know, the only way for me to be able to do more of what I love, which is coaching, is to coach more people. And it's not that I'm going to sell you coaching. It is literally just to provide that coaching experience, because then more people know about coaching. And if it might serve them or someone they know in the future, they can let me know. But if it doesn't, then I've had the opportunity to coach more people and to share my work.
And again, for the benefit of the listeners, if you want, just pause this, skip back like 25 seconds and write down everything Alex said. And there's a beautifully dictated like invitation there that you could just replicate. And this is important because it, I mean, I've talked about this before and probably we'll talk about it more as the, in this new phase of the coach's journey, but it shifts the whole thing more into the agency of the coach, the creation of a coaching business. And it's one of the things, it's like, I really believe it. I really believe what you just said. And I know that's partly because we co-created that in some way together, but that if you're going to put energy into a coaching business, doing it like you said, coaching as many people as possible, is just a possibility-filled way to do it. And it's a lot more fun for most people than, I don't know, whatever else it would be, creating an annoying advert that plays for me after I've done a Duolingo lesson, which I'm surrounded by, you know, 3-day event challenges at the moment when I'm trying to learn Spanish. So, Alex, so like, you... So you went to one day, you did a website, and it's like, that's a good thing to do on the first day. It's like one of the things I did was sort out my website on my first days part-time, like my first days for coaching. I'm sure it was. It's very cool what you said, which is that you maybe did your website, you made sure you had coaching on that day, and you had a meeting with somebody else to talk about ideas so that it wasn't just you. And no worries, I know this is one of your favorite episodes of Phil Bolton sitting watching Bargain Hunt, as Phil said he did when he was first starting out, right? So it's like, that's an amazing thing to do. And again, if people are doing that, like I don't think I had anything. I think I had a bunch of stuff to do, but I don't think I had anything that structured on my first day. And I remember, I can kind of vaguely, I'll go back to the start of the conversation. Maybe this is a real memory, maybe not, but I got a sense that the feeling was one of overwhelm, which may have been there for you, but it sounds like you managed really well. And then, so there were some invitations and some clients that were starting for free. And then how did they become paid clients?
Yeah.
How did you manage that? Because I think that's one of the interesting things that for coaches that's really tricky. Like, how do you take, you sounds like actually you contracted really nicely, which is we'll do 3 free sessions. And after that, that like plants the seed that there'll be a discussion after 3 sessions, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, I remember that specifically for one person I've done work with. And that was kind of, and this was before I heard it as a way of approaching it. It was just like that intuition of, oh, it feels like these 3 sessions have been really valuable. And I think if I were to give advice, which I don't often do, it's a professional hazard. but one of the things I noticed actually 9 times out of 10, if my intuition is good, or if I feel like this is a powerful, impactful, like meaningful coaching session, I will feel that as much as they will feel it. And the reasons I think is meaningful might not be the same reasons they feel. But I had that feeling. I went, it feels like we should keep doing this and it could be a value. And they went, yes, it would be. And then let's explore that. And I think I'd prime them in the previous one going, it's at the next 50 minutes to get that feedback that I asked for. But also we can explore if this is something of value. We can look at it further. But I also very strongly remember, because I'd done some coaching for a few things, like before I was going part-time, I thought, well, you know, let's get some practice coaching people. I'd love to practice. I think that was reading your How I Became a Coach in 2 Years full-time coach blog, in that, you know, one of the things.
Yeah, I'm aware that in that blog I am part of guilty of creating the story of becoming a full-time coach is the only good thing. Although I think hopefully what I was trying to do there really is, for the people who did want to do that, here's some ideas. So you were already doing some coaching before you went part-time.
Yeah, and one of those things being that, think of the people you'd like to coach and just invite them, which I reread that maybe a year ago or half a year ago and remembered, oh yeah, this invitation thing is really powerful. But at the time I had invited people who were like, this is really useful. I think one at that time I was like, I'd really like to try like a leadership program. I never did. And I actually, that's a regret. Maybe I should have. It's that whole, like, again, another thing, and we'll come back to this at the end to like synthesize some of these. But I remember, I think Rich Lipton's business plan is talk to interesting people and make shit up. And yeah, I actually, one of the things I'd like to do more of is that latter thing is like follow the creative energy of like, oh, this is interesting. This interests me. I'd also like to share it. It's like there are some meals that you'll make that are just for you, but there are some that taste so much better when enjoyed with other people. And it's knowing which ones those are and knowing that some of them require a bit more preparation, but actually most of them can be plated up and served. You just need to invite some people along for dinner. And that is something that I didn't do. I spoke to someone who I also wanted to coach and had up. We'd done a bit of coaching going, oh, have a look at this leadership program. And they provide some really valuable feedback. And there was someone else I'd coached through a program that was run at Birkbeck University for business founders. And I think I contacted both of them and they weren't in a position to pursue coaching. And I was like, but where will the people who need coaching be then? Like, these are the only people in the world I know. And so one of the challenges was this like scarcity mindset aspect that, and again, working with you in the coach journey community has definitely helped me like at least become more aware of it. And one of those examples of where it's been really invaluable in full-time work is like charity fundraising or in university where I work, charity fundraising is difficult almost always. And like, there is real scarcity when it comes to something like that, but actually like, framing it, there's also always opportunity. And I also have to appreciate privileged position there of like, there is some resource to go after resource there. And that always makes a huge difference. But meandering again, I think that is to say that yes, the story highlights that first day seems quite structured, but there was quite a bit of like meandering and to and froing. I know that some people would go, you don't need a website. For me, it was really valuable to have a space that almost became like my way of articulating my work to myself, like thinking it through a bit like a canvas. And as part of that, I started blogs like later in the year. And I think that was after reading your 12-minute method article, and mine definitely took more than 12 minutes. But again, there was some joy in it. Actually helped like begin to share work. And it's something I'd love to do more of. I've not been consistent on it, but recognizing that it's almost as you share your work, you become more aware of opportunities. So, for example, I joined the Coach's Journey community, and the same weekend, I think I signed up to Patreon, you shared an opportunity with Unrest, which is a startup, a pre-seed startup accelerator that was looking for coaches for founders. I joined that and since kind of mentioned it to a friend who highlighted Zinc, which was another one. And it's through those opportunities, you know, you start to get more coaching practice, or I've started to gather more practice and just confidence. And that reminder of, oh, yeah, I really love this. The other thing that was consistent for me is I had two coaching exchanges, one of them still going with another coach, so that I could guarantee that every week I would do at least an hour of coaching. And the other week I'd get some coaching as well. And that was really valuable. Just, and again, you put it in your, being sick of Andy, there's some really useful content here. You put it in your how to become a full-time, or how I became a full-time coach, that you're like, do the coaching, remind yourself of the difference it makes. And I think that's what, in different ways, I was trying to do over that last year that's just gone, and seeing, you know, it ramp up. Like the coaching hours, I didn't really, it was interesting, I didn't set specific like material or tangible objectives. It was very much, let's explore this, see what comes about, and play, which I think in itself has been a barrier, or I've used as self-limiting. I'm like, well, I'm just exploring here. I don't want to put like anything big and scary on the table, but that might be the thing that will unfold in 2024.
I mean, it's like hard not to ask about that. If you had to guess now about something big and scary going on the table, like what are the ideas, the little bits of creativity and sparks that you've had about what that might be?
Yeah, the thing that keeps coming to me that really excites me is creating a group of some sort, because I like the idea of it being kind of this community that essentially, and I don't know, I think there's one of them's actually a group program, one of them is more of a subscription type group that we come together, but both are to explore simply the question of like, what is a life well lived? Because that fascinates me, and I think is, I mean, as my thinking's developed over the last year, becoming more aware that a lot of the work I do, or the way I see things more now, is that everything we do is both an exploration and an expression of like of being. And I'd say for a lot of my early 20s, they then became very, if we go back to like books and stuff, they became set as if I was like the book, whereas, you know, I'm the organism. And so it's, yeah, what, creating a space for people to continue to express and explore in that way, but also through those different programs doing that too, going, actually, well, yeah, what else might I want to create or explore? And it's quite funny, I named my coaching business in the pandemic Explore Grow Be, and it feels like actually it's a lot of that is what's coming, is living that more, and so doing more exploration, and both experientially as well as like theoretically, and then seeing what becomes of that. both, yeah, you know, in the, and that's why, you know, if you were to pin me down now and go, well, will you be ever be a full-time coach? I can say I have no idea, because I'm exploring and expressing, and I'm aware that there's also a story there that's the same story that I've had in some way for maybe 15 years of, is this partly in avoiding committing to the thing that, you know, it's that Marianne Williamson thing of like almost being afraid of like our light. And there's probably a bit of that. That's probably going to be part of the work as well. But yeah, to pin down a less meandering answer, exploring some of those different ideas, working towards accreditation, because I've got everything I need to be accredited. But again, I think there's that like turning professional thing. But actually something that really excites me, I was talking to someone that's a psychotherapist and a coach, well, I think when I was starting out early on, and they're talking about the beauty of something like coaching is that it isn't a what's this job you're doing? It's like, what's this craft you're committing to for the next 10, 20 years? And what could it be? And I really love that idea of it becoming a craft, mm-hmm. or being a craft for me, even if, you know, the fact that I've not done a huge amount of formally worked with accreditation suggests that there's some resistance there of that kind of like that commitment.
Yeah, or like, you know, my view would be on accreditation, I think I've talked about this before, like it's great if you want to do it. And it's not the only way to work on a craft. In fact, it has some, like you can use it for that. I really did when I got an ICF credential, but I didn't get an ICF credential for a while because I looked at it and I thought, this isn't that good a way of me, you know, developing this craft. There's other better ways to do it. If I'm going to spend a few hundred pounds or whatever it costs to do that and all these hours, then that's one thing. You know, as an aside, the things you have to do to get a credential usually include things that are really good for sorting out the craft, like, you know, recording yourself, listening to yourself back, doing coaching, getting mentor coaching and supervision. Like all those things are great, but the credential, this isn't the problem I have a little sometimes, because I'm not that interested in labels. Yeah. And the place that lets me down is sometimes I don't have any labels. It's what it used to feel like when I was starting out. I used to love working with a friend of mine, Nicole Brigandi, because she's, you know, just her CV reads like she's worked for, anyway, you just like, yeah. Google Nicole Brigandi, you look at her LinkedIn, you'll just be like, oh, look at all these, you know, companies you've worked for and that kind of thing. You look at mine, it says, you know, used to be an administrator at the Royal Opera House. And it's like, well, that's because I have a different attitude to these things. But right, it could be a craft that you're committed to. And it's not obvious to me having this conversation, like you said, I don't know where I'll end up. It's not obvious to me whether that craft is best developed by itself. Or that actually, like it sounds like at the moment, like Universify is an amazing place to develop that craft. Like I really kind of, when I think back on my career, I wish I'd had coaching skills when I was a manager, just because of the different way that I would be experienced at using them in all kinds of different ways. And there's kind of, there's so much more on that. I guess I've got a bunch of questions that I still want to ask you, so we'll kind of go to them in a more quickfire way in a minute. But before, I wanted just so that we've got it, like now in this moment, because we'll probably, listeners will learn this as they, more about this as time goes on, and we might speak about it again in the future. So what does your coaching look like now? You've got this one day a week. Mm-hmm. There's some work with Unrest and Zinc, which people can look up and we can put links to. Like how do you think about your coaching business and who you work with now?
Yeah, I will answer that. But I want to catch something you just said, which was, you know, that having coaching skills in like a professional context, I think is great. But I think the challenge that I always have is balancing the being and the doing and recognizing that, because so much of the power of coaching is from how we are, not what we do. I'm remembering that when, you know, there's a long to-do list, but actually like the value here is for me to be and to be present, to be considerate and be open in the ways that you might as a coach and kind of believe the answer's there. And it might not be by simply bashing through the to-do list. At times it will be, but actually that balancing of the being and doing feels like a really important thing to articulate, because I also think that it's all well and good people gathering coaching skills, but it's actually the approach that probably will make the biggest difference, and remembering that, because it's something I, you know, juggle and don't do all that well all the time, even though I spend 20% of my working week doing it full time.
Yeah, in a way, it's easier. I'm just getting that picture. It's easier to do it when you're doing it, rather than as a leader, you have to balance all the different. I was on a podcast where somebody called it the dominant stance. It's like, what's your dominant stance? Well, as a leader or a manager, you might choose, there will be different moments where a different dominant stance is required. Yeah. I love that. Yeah.
I don't know why, but the thing I might try, I'll get some weird looks at work, is that point, right? That because a coach has nothing that identifies them as a coach. Whereas, so like, maybe if I could create some sort of uniform that I wear throughout the week, actually that's that reminder of, oh wait, you can always be a coach. There's always a coaching approach to that, which if my colleagues listen back to it, which they might not because they'll think 2 hours, then they'll hate me for this, because there's those times where I just like, Alex, I just need your advice on this thing, which again is an interesting thing in the workplace. I mean, we could spend another hour talking about coaching and coaching in a workspace.
So let's change gear. One of the things that stands out in all your biographies is that you always mention rugby. And I once asked, we've never met in person, and I once asked when I read that you were so interested in rugby, that, like, because you never know, I always assume when I'm talking to someone on Zoom that they're essentially exactly my height. And I was like, Alex might be like a 6'6" flanker for all I know from Zoom. But we had a great question from a member of the community who was asking, how does your love of rugby inform your coaching approach or interest in coaching? Like, are they connected? And if so, how? Because I guess you may have had some, you know, in between the life coach on Channel 5 and first getting the Coach Bright training, you might have had rugby coaches.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a really lovely question. And I think my biography and my website at the moment talks about how I wish I had a coach when I was going through the period where I really was serious about pursuing rugby as a profession, which is interesting because obviously I had coaches, but not coaches in the way that you or I would describe ourselves as a coach. And I think there was a really interesting thing because I recently did some rugby coaching and sadly had to give it up because of other time commitments with work. Noticing that it informs it in that balancing of where is it useful to share my voice versus actually how can I trust an individual to, you know, be intuitive. I mean, Nina Game of Tennis is one of my favorite books for this, of like actually understanding the feeling and listening to Johnny Wilkinson has a podcast. He did an episode with Dave Allwood, who was his kicking coach, and all they talk about is what does it feel like as you perform a motion like a kick. And that, I think, is really interesting because I'm really fascinated by how, actually, in a sporting context, coaching in the way that in a pure form that we do, rather than a kind of skill articulation of, oh, you should put your hand over the ball to do this kind of pass, but actually, well, what's that pass feel like, is really interesting. And I think lots of the criticism of the England rugby team recently has been about basically having a very set game plan, and as soon as they get that game plan stops working, then not being able to do much and to think for themselves on the pitch. And actually, that probably boils it down. There's a lot more technical things that I'm not aware of. But there's a really interesting thing of actually that, what are they noticing? How are they approaching this? That fascinates me. So there's always an interest, I suppose, to answer that question of how that application might work. But also, again, the dedication. I think what I've noticed, what coaching has really taught me, is it's humanized other people in a way that perhaps, without realizing, have quite a few imposter tendencies that of like, am I good enough among my anyone sometimes, which then, because you see all of the things that they're, the amazing things, that extraordinary things they're doing, but then actually through coaching, you realize that we are all human and navigating different challenges in different ways. And I remember, yeah, and that's really where someone might say, this is really, I can't do this really simple thing. And I'm like, whoa, that's simple for someone, but it might not be simple in another context. And yeah, so there's a beautiful part there, I think, in I have a better appreciation, I think, for the commitment and dedication of any like professional athlete. But also, yeah, there's an interesting thing within like how might a more open approach to coaching. And again, this shows lack of knowledge of actually how rugby coaches work, less technical, more feel-based, what that might do.
Yeah, and also kind of hearing there that it's a part of what reminds you of the potential power of coaching, right? And from your story about why it would have been powerful for you to have a coach at that time. Just for context, people listening, we're speaking between England losing tantalizingly to South Africa in the World Cup semi-final and the third place playoff, but it was a very strange tournament for England. I really heard what you said, like, you know, even the first game against Argentina, you know, the plan out the window as soon as Curry is sent off, and no real recovery except George Ford just like doing crazy things. Like that's where that win comes from. I wonder, Alex, can you just say, I don't think you said this, why would it have been made such a difference for you to have had a coach when you were interested in pursuing rugby as a career, and what stopped you doing that?
Well, I think it's because I had some really excellent coaches. And can specifically remember some tours where one sat down, I think, for like a good hour and was like, I think you're really good. Like, you should believe in your abilities. I think a coach should have been helpful because at the time I maybe didn't, there's that weird thing of like, you want something, but you don't believe in your ability to actually get there or to like commit to at least trying. I suppose it's like, I mean, Carl Rogers might differentiate the ideal self versus the real self, and probably not being aware that there's like a bridge that can be drawn, and they can actually kind of that peak can be flattened, and then they can kind of like integrate. But I think it would have helped with that commitment, and then like the mindset of, you know, well, what if this is what you want, what are you doing? I think it's that that was interesting, because I'm not saying, and it's kind of beside the point whether I was good enough, because there's a lot of things that will get in the way, and actually injuries is a huge issue for me. But like I suppose there's always this question of what if I approached it in a way that I might approach something now. And to the point we were talking about earlier, did I at that age have the capacity to do that as well? It's really interesting, and there's loads of stories we can tell around that. But yeah, I think it's that creating that self-direction.
And were you a giant flanker?
I wasn't a flanker. I was actually a prop. There's some really funny pictures.
Wait, so are you like 3.5 feet wide?
No. And there's some really funny pictures.
4 feet wide, probably more than that. I don't know how wide those props are.
A wedding recently, wearing a suit that I had as a 16-year-old, where I am dwarfed by the suit. It looks like, you know, the whole when you wear your dad's suit to work or to school kind of thing. It felt like that. And someone would be like, Alex, you must be one of the only people that's smaller now than they were when they were 16.
I love it. I love that you were a prop. That is exactly the kind of thing that I would have loved to have discovered in person if you had still been prop sized. But if you're not, that's a different
thing. I had a really funny, we won't talk about the World Cup too much. There's a really funny point in that. There's loads of news articles in that England basically lost because unfortunately their South African scrum is unbelievable. Yeah. But the person they brought in, Dan Cole, who's had like a 13-year career, he's not the flashy prop that can do all the things. He just pushes and hits rucks, which was me. I'm 29 now, and I was saying to my partner, I was like, I've missed a great career opportunity here. I mean,
you could have been drafted in alongside Cole. Maybe they wouldn't have given away a penalty at every scrum in the second half.
Well, exactly. Yeah, that's clearly the only reason England aren't in the World Cup final.
I like it.
My nose is as straight as it is.
And your ears are fine. Exactly. So, Alex, we're coming towards the end of the conversation. There's a whole load of things on my notes page that we'll probably won't have time to ask you about. One of the things that came from one of the prompts that someone you really know sent through is, I'm wondering that, you know, they ask, where do you get your inspiration, whether that's books or people or quotes? And through that, I'm wondering, particularly because there's that blog post that I mentioned before, like, how do you think about inspiration and where you use it and need it?
Yeah, inspiration, I think, it's always come from my family, both my parents and my sister, in that I've got a twin sister who's doing medicine, and just her, I think her no-nonsense approach to the fact she was like, I want to be a doctor, and has pursued it, and is, and just her approach to life is really inspiring, because I'm probably the hesitant, oh, should I do this? And she's like, I want to do this, I'm going to do it. That's inspiring. I think the way that my parents have always, I'm really fortunate in the way they've supported me or gone, well, what can we do to give you the things that we might never have had, or just the opportunities, but also always go, you know, we'll support you with what you want to do. So when I, you know, go, I don't want to do this like traditional career thing, they've been really open to that, and that's been amazing. So definite inspiration from, you know, like people I've been raised by and with, who have just both supported following where my enthusiasms might lie, or taking the time to work it out without the pressure on myself, and also watching other people do it. And likewise, friends, I think I'm surrounded by, like, you know, very grateful for the friends I have who, yeah, are doing really cool. I talk to one of my friends now as we like border on our 30s, and it's like, it's really lovely seeing how the lives that everyone has created of our friends, and they're all very different, but doing really cool things, like friends leaving their jobs to start businesses because they want to. Like a friend is actually going through the Zinc program now, for example. Friends doing career transitions, and then beyond careers, like starting lives that they want that might not feel traditional. So yeah, not just a career centric aspect. It's really inspiring, and being surrounded by those people. So yeah, people significantly. And yeah, I think feel grateful that I'm surrounded by people of different generations too. It's not a shameless plug, but the Coaches Journey community, there are some incredible people, doing incredible things. And then I suppose people I don't know, or I might know parasocially, let's go back to episode 56 for that one.
like definitely, parasocial is definitely now a Coaches Journey host in joke, isn't it? Yeah. Again, go back to 56, you'll find out why.
Inspirations, recent one, like on that theme of exploring kind of different ways of being, I read a book by an anthropologist that's exploring like different ancient wisdoms. And so actually just...
What's the book for people who are interested?
Yeah, it's a really wonderful book. It's by Wade Davis, and it's called Wayfinders.
Yeah, he's the like explorer guy.
Yeah,
he was an amazing interview on the Tim Ferriss show.
Is there? With Wade Davis. Yeah, there's a... I mean, probably one of the coolest job titles ever, which is Explorer in Residence for National Geographic.
Yeah, amazing guy, amazing stories in that show, some of which are in Wayfinders.
Yeah.
Alex, there's this great, I was reading your blog earlier, and it says, answering yes to questions like, does it matter, or can I control the outcomes of worrying I'm worrying about anyway, which is what you, when you're tackling self-limiting beliefs, are asking yourself. If you answer yes, you know, it has impacts big and small. And one of the small ones you give as an example is you're still writing a blog post that you started like a year earlier. And then it says, don't even ask me about the novel I started in 2014. And I read that thinking, well, I'm interviewing Alex. So Alex, tell us about the novel you started in 2014.
I suppose that one's actually... That one's finished. I don't know where. I think I'd have to load up an old laptop to get it out. And that's going back to that analogy that I use at coaching of like, you know, we do things without even thinking about them first, and then to do them again is a nightmare or so much more challenging. I think I was in my final year of university, and I was just really unwell, and I had like 20 minutes to kill, so just started writing. Writing has been something. And to the thread that we've been talking about, you know, can a young person really know what they want? I do remember in primary school, I think it must have been 8, talking about, oh yeah, I'd love to be an author. I couldn't tell you why. It's just that like intuition, which is really interesting because that's one of the few things that's come back around. I wrote that, and I know what happened to it. Is I even sat down, this is my first year of full-time work, so this has been 2016, sat down, edited it, finished it, and then went, I probably need some really good edit now, but I think and then went, brilliant, so this is what it's about, these are all the books I need now to read that I can then like put into this to make it much better, and then stopped. And that probably is at that point at which like the me disappeared, as I started like really focusing on others and everyone a bit more, but then picked it up just before the pandemic, picked writing up, so finished the second thing, which I really, I think I'm on page 100 of reading through again, so really interesting. When I was journaling the other day, I was like, I think it was linked to this call in the show 56, where I was like, or episode 56, where I was like, oh, creativity both breeds creativity, but it's exciting. I need to create some more. And I'm like, I really need to pick that up. I really need to finish it and share it in some way. I sometimes wonder whether this coaching thing is the first step towards that. Because I think when I was writing in 2014, there's a question of like, would I ever put my name to it, which is just a vulnerability thing. And also there's this thing that you, I think I've definitely struggled with when doing coaching, is that the person I was when I started exploring coaching to who I am now is completely different. And the real worry of like, do the people I've known the longest, am I still who I am to them? And like almost the vulnerability of actually who might I be? And as I go, as I explore further, it's like, what might I be? And will they be with me? And that's scary, but also like part of transition and change. And it's probably the same thing that's got in the way of writing or sharing my work, is like, well, it's not, you know, the person that you don't know, it's people that know you really well. People like, how do they then hold this thing that actually shows a part of you that they've never known? But that's part of like creativity. And I suppose actually one of the things that really motivates me as a coach is that idea of, if we can be our fullest self, be authentic, connected beings, kind of, we don't actually know what impact that will make or who will be inspired by that authenticity, but they will be more themselves as a result. And that's a really beautiful ripple effect, I think. It's kind of, there's this sense of, I spend a lot of time trying to do things to make a difference, but actually probably the thing that will make the most difference is simply like being me as fully as I can in each moment.
Alex, in a way, that feels like the perfect time to stop the conversation. But before we do, I just want to, you know, if you want, in a couple of minutes, another great question that came in from one of your friends that you got was, what advice would you have to people who are just starting out doing this thing, coaching? What are the things you wish you'd known sooner?
I think the biggest point of advice actually is that you can create, is know what's the coaching thing you're creating, what's the life you want it to contribute to? Because you can create whatever you want as a coaching business. And there's no one right way. And if there's anything to take away from any Coach's Journey podcast episode, it is that, is that, you know, you can create it in whatever way you want it to be, that uses what is meaningful to you. I will also consult my list for the sake of time. I think we've touched some of these. I think the other part is, and it came out from a call with you, Robbie, is I do the work in the sense of both to share your work as a coach, to develop your craft. So, you know, if I'm framing that as in questions for people to reflect, like, what is the thing that is going to get in the way of me, like, being the coach I want to be? What can I do to be more comfortable stepping into that, to create like the conditions for it? But also being aware that you don't have to be, for want of a better word, fixed to be able to start doing that work. Because you know, being a coach is an evolving, explorative process. That's like it's only one part of us being. So I take that and therefore play around, make things up, follow your energy. But I think if anything, like consistency as well. So like consider what you want, what's the way to be consistent, and yeah, give space to that. The image that comes to head, as I promised a short answer, is the, which is another inspiration, although not a coach, it's a lot of the work of Carl Rogers. It talks about ideas like positive self-regard, unconditional positive regard, which is basically love in psychologist terms. But he has this beautiful analogy that we're all organisms, and he compares it to a potato, which as a child they'd put the potatoes under the stairs and they'd root these purple roots. And it highlights that in any conditions, this organism, we're all organisms seeking to grow to fulfill our potential or realize that potential. But this potato is never going to become more potatoes because it hasn't got the right conditions. So consider that as ourselves and ourselves as the coaching practice we want. What are the conditions we need to grow, to not only grow that coaching business, but to grow like the life we want as well?
Yeah, amazing. Love it, Alex. And so looking forward over the next few months to hearing you help other coaches like pull out some of those conditions that can help each of us do our thing. Something you said in one of your on your website somewhere as well, which is like your long-winded route to coaching. And it doesn't feel like that to me in this conversation. It felt like you came across coaching, you know, at a like really early in your life. And I'm excited for what's going to happen for you as you work out what that means for you in the next phase of your work as a CEO and as a coach. But also it's for the reasons we've talked about, I'm really glad that the work of the company brings coaching and questions of fulfilling potential to those kind of people that it does, because I think that we just don't know what happens in the world when you get asked those kinds of questions at that younger age, but I'm pretty sure it's a good thing. So thanks so much for your energy and wisdom today. And yeah, people will look forward to hearing you on this side of the Zoom call and conversation pretty soon.
Yeah, thanks, Robbie. It's been a real pleasure.
Hello, Robbie here again. A couple of quick things before you go on to whatever else you've got going on in the rest of your day. And that is, if you've enjoyed this conversation, then you might be interested in becoming a supporter of the Coach's Journey podcast or joining the Coach's Journey community. Both of those are ways to support the show, help it continue, help it reach more and more people, but they also give you other things that you might be interested in. If you become a supporter, which is paying a small amount of money every month, then you'll get advance notice of guests, perhaps the chance to ask questions of guests, depending on what membership level you have, and more monthly video updates from me, all kinds of other bits and pieces. And if you join the Coach's Journey community, then you get all of that. Plus, you get to be part of a group coaching program led by me and attend group coaching calls up to 10 times a year, have one-on-one coaching with me, and be part of a community of coaches who want to create thriving coaching businesses and thrive as people while they do it. And one of the members said recently that the word that keeps coming up in the members' WhatsApp group is beautiful to describe those calls. And so I'd love to have you there on one of those calls. And as a member of the community or a supporter of the show, it'd mean the world to me and it helped me to keep doing this thing that I love to do and that many, many people have told me is really helpful for them. So thanks very much for listening and hope to have you back with us on the Coach's Journey podcast sometime soon.